Jeff Flyer and I wrote some articles critical of this early in the pandemic, saying that we need to listen to scientists with different points of view, and we need to think about all the negative consequences of lockdown. We had data from China very early on that it essentially had no lethality in young people. I mean, there is a rate of death in people under the age of 18, but it is so fleetingly low, it makes no sense to restrict their movements and restrict their school, given the value of school. But the bigger point is that it seems like Monday morning quarterback because the people who set the policy squelched all attempts at any dissenting opinion and did not allow the public to hear the points of view of people who disagreed at the time.
And now, The Good Fight with Yascha Monk.
About 5 years ago, I read The Free Body Problem, the wonderful Chinese science fiction novel by Kaixin Liu. And like many other people, I have been watching the Netflix adaptation over the course of the last weeks. I have one episode to go. The pivotal moment of the early part of the series, and I promise that this is not much of a spoiler, comes when Wen Zheye is working at a Chinese research observatory, which is scanning the skies for messages from extraterrestrial life. And even though she is warned not to respond in a message, they do in fact intercept from outer space, from someone saying, "I'm a pacifist in this world. You're lucky, but I am the first to receive your message. I'm warning you, do not answer. If you respond, we will come. Your world will be conquered. Do not answer." Wenja responds that the aliens should come. "We cannot save ourselves. I will help you conquer this world." This is, of course, a science fiction dramatization, which is much unlike anything that would happen in reality. It's hard to imagine that an alien species would let a pacifist send those messages rather than using their technical capabilities to survey that person and ensure they don't betray the mission. And most of the scientists on Earth don't have Wen Zheye's dramatic backstory of living through the Cultural Revolution and seeing her own father beaten to death by his students for refusing to disown the laws of physics. And yet, I think that the debate which this exchange dramatizes is, in fact, a very real one. There are people trying to send and arguing that we should send explicit messages to aliens who might be able to receive them to advertise our existence, to enter into communication with them. And that, I think, is a big mistake. Now, I know conversations about aliens always have a vague whiff of wackiness. There's no serious reason to think that UFOs have visited the Earth. Little green men are not hiding out on Mars. But physicists do believe that there is a good chance of some form of intelligent life existing in the vast stretches of the universe. And the only possible reason to contact alien life, not to listen, which is one thing, but to deliberately send messages from Earth that would be easier for them to intercept and to understand, is to make contact with these hypothetical creatures. Now, we can assume that if they're able to receive those messages, if they're able to respond, certainly if they're able to make contact with us in a more robust way, they must be at a much higher level of development. Another reason to think that is that we're just at the very beginning of our ability to communicate with outer space, and it is unlikely that anybody intercepting that message would similarly be right at the beginning of their ability to do that. And if they've been able to do it for much longer, then they presumably are at a much higher level of technological development. And if there's one thing that we should have learned from the history of how humans have interacted with other cultures that were less technologically developed, it is that this rarely was to the benefit of those who were colonized. We don't know how alien species might respond to us. Perhaps they would come and give us the benefit of their great moral insights and their great technological inventions. But that is pure speculation. What we do know is that most species that succeed have outcompeted other species, often in brutal ways. And that on Earth, contact between civilizations at a higher level of technological development and those at a lower level of technological development have not ended well for the latter. This is at best rolling the dice. And despite all the reasons for concern about the state of the world, I don't think that our current lives are nearly bad enough to justify rolling the dice on whether or not we are inviting aliens to come and colonize our planet. Are we likely to make a difference in whether or not aliens actually spot us? Do we know what the consequences are going to be? No. But this is one case in which the maxim of do no harm actually does make sense. We do not want to follow in the footsteps of Wenjie Ye and become traitors to our own species. We have not given legitimacy to anybody trying to advertise our existence to the outside world in this way. And even if the likelihood of any of these fanciful sounding sci-fi scenarios coming to pass is extremely low, the only purpose of sending out messages into outer space is the hypothetical that this kind of extraterrestrial intelligent life capable of communicating with and perhaps conquering us does in fact exist. So, I mean, a little jokingly, but also quite earnestly, that we should oppose what has come to be called as METI, or messaging to extraterrestrial intelligence. My guest today is Vinay Prasad. Vinay is a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco, and he's the author of a number of books, including Malignant, How Bad Policy and Bad Evidence Harm People with Cancer. Vinay has become well-known for his criticisms of COVID policy. As you'll see, he believes that COVID was a very, very serious disease that killed many people. He believes that the vaccines helped to save the lives of many, many people, especially elderly people who would otherwise have perished. But he's critical of the way in which public health officials try to shut down debate about various aspects of the disease. He's critical about school closures. He's critical about some of the guidance on who should wear masks. And he's critical about government mandates for people to become vaccinated once we had learned that the vaccine does not necessarily protect us against transmission of the disease. We had a fun, spirited debate about how to think in retrospect about the pandemic and our public policy failures. This conversation is a part of a cooperation that we have with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the Arthur Winning Davis Foundation. MIT is running a civil discourse initiative with a lot of interesting and heterodox thinkers who are coming to campus. And Vinay was at MIT recently debating Pekka Hosoi on these issues. Vinay Prasad, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been writing a lot about our public health response to COVID. Now that the beginning of this pandemic is about 4 years away, it really has been a long period of time at this point. How do you assess, on the whole, our response to it?
I think this is something that might even align with my critics, as I think our response was very poor, but we can talk about the specific policies. I think in general, we made two types of errors. There are lots of things we could have done, we didn't do, and we neglected, particularly around the elderly. And then I think in general, our response towards young people and people in their 20s and 30s was heavy-handed and overbearing and violated some of the norms of Western democratic free society.
So I look forward to the particular criticisms. I mean, it strikes me that when we talk about this topic right now, we often talk about various ways in which the response was heavy-handed or overly restrictive. And I'm sympathetic to some of those arguments. I look forward to getting into those. But the sort of more basic failure is a different one, right? I mean, Centers for Disease Control were built to stop and control epidemics. And at the beginning, when we started to hear about the spread of this viral disease, the hope was that we were going to quarantine people and isolate them and do case tracking and tracing and all of that in such a way that the disease wouldn't end up infecting most of the population. Is that a failure? Was that something that a better public health system would have actually succeeded in doing, you know, back in January and February of 2020? Or do you think that given the particular nature of this disease, that was just never in the cards? We were never going to be able to control it.
So if the question is, could this disease ever have been contained? And the answer is maybe only if China had been cooperative early in December of 2019. I think by January and February, the horse was out of the barn. It's a highly contagious virus. It had seeded the entire globe. And so by March, I think we had widespread transmission in every continent. And so I think containment was always not possible. There are some people who believed in zero COVID, even in March and April and June and July and 2021. They thought we could have zero COVID, we could stop all transmission. I think that was incredibly naive. COVID-19 has animal reservoirs. You know, we had data that it was infected the majority of white-tailed deer, for instance, in Michigan. You know, it's affected other animal species. Containment, I think, was not an option from the moment in which U.S. policymakers took it seriously.
Interesting. And why is it that the CDC has actually had a good track record in the last decades of stopping all kinds of other potential epidemics from taking place, including ones based on respiratory diseases? But you're saying, you know, with COVID, that just wasn't possible. What are the sort of specific characteristics of this virus that made it so much harder to contain and control than others? If you don't think it's because of failures of the CDC to take the right steps in February and March of 2020.
Yeah, I don't think, in February of March, I think it was impossible for them. But some of the salient differences about the virus is, one, there's a lot of people who are infected who are only mildly or asymptomatic. That's a difference than other viruses. Number two, it's extremely transmissible. It's highly contagious, unlike other viruses. Number three, it's spread by breathing, spread by aerosol, spread by breath, rather than something like Ebola, which is much more able to be contained. SARS-1, for instance, might be a similar comparison, but SARS-1, of course, the majority of people who get it get very sick, and there's a period of time in which you can quarantine them. So I think these are some of the salient differences. And finally, a government that wasn't cooperative. You know, China did not let us know that the outbreak had even occurred. And so there was all these kinds of obfuscation that made it harder. But I'm of the belief that I think once you had reached even January of 2020, unable to contain the virus.
All right, so let's take that as read, that there really wasn't a way to successfully contain the virus. And of course, the problem was that wasn't sort of completely obvious early on, right? I remember even when people first advocated social distancing, and I was one of the early advocates of social distancing. You know, I wrote an article that went very viral in The Atlantic on, I believe, March 6th of 2020, arguing for that. The idea was to flatten the curve, right? It was that we're just going to reduce the number of people who are in need of immediate treatment in hospitals long enough to ensure that the hospital system is not going to get overwhelmed in the way it clearly did get in Wuhan in China, and arguably in some parts in northern Italy and Bergamo and other places. And that would then drive down the number of fatalities. And then it sort of turned into this much more long-term policy. What were the steps that we were taking once we started to actually recognize the danger of COVID? And where would you argue that we started to go wrong?
I guess just a few thoughts there. I mean, social distancing means two things. One is voluntary social distancing. And in the United States, from cell phone tracking data, we know that when people see cases going up, there is a massive voluntary behavioral change that occurs. People are less likely to go out and less likely to see people, and they take risks in different ways. We did something beyond that, of course, in the United States. We used the power of the police state to enforce lockdowns. And that, I think, is a bad policy decision. That was not in line with prior public health guidance. It was learned from a totalitarian regime. There's very little evidence that it actually improved things beyond voluntary changes. And it led to a lot of resentment. And I think it was an infringement on freedoms. And you talked about flattening the curve. I think flattening the curve made a lot of sense. It made sense to prevent healthcare collapse. If you get a huge flood of patients to the hospital all at the same time, and they're inundated, you get healthcare collapse, and then the fatality rate can balloon because you can't provide basic healthcare measures. But ironically, what we did in this country was we had healthcare collapse or near collapse in New York City. But besides that, we flattened the curve in places that had essentially very low healthcare utilization. The hospitals were empty. So we weren't flattening the curve to prevent healthcare collapse. We were having lockdowns instituted with the authority of the police state, and there was nobody in the hospital. There wasn't elective cases. There weren't few many COVID cases. And then finally, when we relaxed those pressures by the summer of 2020, places like South Dakota, who had been fatigued and fed up with this sort of top-down restriction, you know, they had outbreaks and epidemic spread, and they were not able to institute politically those kind of measures again, or even to sort of change the minds of people. So in many ways, I think most of the lockdowns in early 2020 were too much and at the wrong time. There wasn't transmission in those counties, or much transmission.
So I think one useful thing to do in politics always is to distinguish between mistakes that were noble at the time and mistakes that are obvious in hindsight. There was a strange creep of these pandemic measures, right? When I wrote that article called Cancel Everything, the debate was about the huge indoor concerts that were still going to take place a few days later. I wrote to somebody who was part of the Joe Biden campaign at the time and say, you guys are still planning a huge indoor rally in, I believe, Michigan on Tuesday. You should call off that rally, right? So this wasn't, I was not saying we should use the force of a state in order to tell people they're not allowed to leave their house or they have to, no, they're not allowed to access beaches. It was really about shifting behavior so that employees are allowed to stay at home rather than having to go to the office, so that some of these mass events that would quite likely be, you know, spread the virus very quickly would be called off. Within, you know, a very, very, very short period of time, that then turned into state-imposed curfews and other kinds of measures that really restricted the freedom of movement of people. And I think that in hindsight, it's frightening how quickly we did that. But at the same time, we were seeing the collapse of the healthcare system in parts of New York, the overstretching of it. There was, at the time, understandable fears that the same was about to happen in all of these other kinds of localities. We didn't know to what extent people would respond to these voluntary measures. Is this, you think, a mistake that is obvious in hindsight? Or is it a mistake that should have been obvious, you know, on March 15th, April 1st of 2020?
So I just want to be clear. My criticism is not a referendum on your involvement in all this. It's not about, you know, your article, which I think is perfectly reasonable to have written at the time. It's really a criticism of the people who were in charge of the policy. So I think Francis Collins and Anthony Fauci, they were aware that many scientists disagreed with their point of view. They held zero debates on the topic. They refused to entertain those opinions. Now we have FOIA emails from Francis Collins saying that when he read the Great Barrington Declaration, and for your listeners who want to know, the Great Barrington Declaration was 16,000 scientists wrote a petition that said we ought to focus our response on strict precautions around the elderly and largely let most healthy young people return to normal life, particularly resume schools. And when Francis Collins read that petition, he wrote an email saying we need a, quote, quick and devastating takedown of this, end quote. He didn't write an email saying, maybe we should have some public discussions and put these on YouTube and let people hear the pros and cons to this. So I guess one thing I'd say is that, in my opinion, this was not Monday morning quarterback. I think there were plenty of people at the time who were opposed to these measures. You know, Jeff Flier and I wrote some articles critical of this early in the pandemic saying that we need to listen to scientists with different points of view and we need to think about all the negative consequences of lockdown. That's one. Two, we had data from China very early on that it essentially had no lethality in young people. I mean, there is a rate of death in people under the age of 18, but it is so fleetingly low, it makes no sense to restrict their movements and restrict their school given the value of school. But the bigger point is that it seems like Monday morning quarterback because the people who set the policy squelched all attempts at any dissenting opinion and did not allow the public to hear the points of view of people who disagreed at the time. So it feels like it's being said in retrospect. But at the time, I was on many email chains and people were privately quite upset. The last thing I'd say is, where does lockdown even come from? If the same pandemic happened in 1999, I'm sure you would not get lockdown. A couple of things had to coalesce for lockdown to occur. One, we had to learn that lockdown was an option from Beijing. We had to learn from a totalitarian regime. That was not in public health guidance. Number two, there are papers by D.A. Henderson, the man who eradicated smallpox in the mid-2000s, saying that, you know, lockdown, even for pandemic influenza and school closure, are last resort measures. And they cautioned that we should not even consider school closure unless a million children will die. Here we're talking about the cumulative death rate of COVID-19 among children is, you know, 1 to 2,000. We can debate the exact number. But it's nothing like what they had postulated for closing schools. And then the final thing I'd say is technology. If we didn't have Zoom and Uber Eats and Amazon and YouTube and Facebook, we would not have had lockdown. Technology allows upper-middle-class people to continue to get their salary without being laid off. If they had to live in 1999, we would have had people coming to work and trying to do the best we can and have a harm reduction strategy. And then the last thing I'd say is, I think there was data at the time that voluntary behavioral change does, you know, a huge amount, something like 97% of the mobility change is voluntary. Using the police state just leads to a lot of societal friction. The few people who do have to go because they have some extenuating circumstance are stopped, are detained, you know, had somebody have, you know, and this happened, you know, all over. And that's problematic. And finally, border closure, which is really mostly xenophobic, border closure did not stop any variant at any time, ever, really didn't serve much purpose other than making it difficult for the few people who did have to travel for other reasons. So, I don't know. My opinion is that most of it was wrong at the time, and it was done because people were scared, some ways hysterical, and then they overreacted, I think.
Yeah, and I think your distinction between what were particular policies in which we can have a debate and go back and forth, and it's going to be subtle and complicated, you know, what was mistakes that should have been obvious at the time, what are mistakes that are obvious in hindsight, and then why did we not have a debate about these ideas? Why was the instinct of public health officials to squelch debate about whether or not we should have school closures, but also, of course, about questions like what the origin of the virus might be? And why is it even more damagingly, you might expect a government to try and spin its narrative of events that presumably people believed in, who are trying to spin it in that way. That's a normal behavior by governments, right? But the point is supposed to be that there's a free press and journalists who then interrogate the government narrative and try and show that there's other kinds of ways of possibly thinking about it. Why is it that so many journalists came to understand the job as being corralling the public into following government guidance rather than being the sort of independent-minded interrogators who always have a healthy dose of skepticism towards anything that a government says? Tell us a little bit about the way in which that space for debate was closed down, both in the broader public and in the sort of medical and scientific community that you are part of.
I guess I also want to draw a distinction between when Trump was in office and when Biden was in office, because I think things changed dramatically. When Trump was in office, Trump and the media are not on the same team. Okay, so I think there was a natural tension between Trump and the media. So Trump famously didn't want to wear masks. The media suddenly made it that cloth masks were the greatest thing since sliced bread. And of course, now we know cloth masks don't work. Donald Trump, I don't agree with on everything, but like a broken watch, he's right twice a day. Donald Trump wanted to reopen schools in the summer of 2020. There's public opinion data that shows very clearly the public supported school reopening the moment he said it at the end of June 2020. 1 week later, there was a massive flip and it was almost exactly partisan lines. Democrats were much more likely to support school closure. Famously, Apoorva Mandavilli, the New York Times reporter, she said that the mere even to entertain the idea of lab leak was a racist idea, she said on Twitter. Meanwhile, it's not clear to me that entertaining the idea that people are eating exotic animals is any less racist than entertaining the idea that there was an accidental lab leak. Why did she say that? I think most of the people in the media championed the establishment public health view, which tends to be on the political left because people in public health tend to be on the political left. And the establishment public health view in 2020 was lockdowns, more is better. School closure, that's good because the virus is bad for kids. Masking, great. Masking two-year-olds, even better. And the origin of the virus, it must be natural. It cannot be lab leak. One last thing I want to say. We didn't talk about one of the structural problems I see in the pandemic, which was the man on television every day, Anthony Fauci, who I believe has made numerous errors, including obfuscating the origin of the virus, in part because he may have funded it, two, his statements on masking, which were inaccurate at the time that he said it, his statements on school reopening. He opposed DeSantis reopening schools in 2020, famously on TV. He made a lot of errors. Many people I know in infectious disease and epidemiology wanted to be critical of him, but why weren't they? Because he has two roles. One, he was the public spokesperson for pandemic policy. And two, he is the person in charge of everybody's grant funding from NIAID, the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease. So you have the same person who controls our research budget and is the public face of policy. And I think that is a huge structural problem because nobody will want to be critical of the person who you think controls your grant renewal, who controls your livelihood. And so naturally, I think people were reluctant to criticize him. And that led to, I think, further policy distortions. And then the final thing is, when people are scared, they don't want to debate. I mean, I think it was easy to talk rationally about Ebola because it felt like it couldn't happen to us. But it's extremely difficult to talk about COVID-19 rationally to epidemiologists because they're all worried about their own skin. And I think that makes people very unlikely to engage in reason.
One of the things that I found striking about the public debate is how easily the consensus flipped back and forth between different positions. So what we remember about masking is that it was encouraged and that now some of the scientific evidence about at least the kind of straightforward paper masks is calling in doubt how useful that was. But if you actually zoom back a little bit more, the story is even wilder than that, right? Because in February of 2020, and I think through early to mid-March of 2020, the concern, understandably, was that a lot of medical personnel didn't have access to personal protective equipment, to PPE. And so therefore, people didn't want ordinary citizens to go out there and buying up all of the sparse mask supply because hospitals needed them. And so at the time, a lot of the messaging from the CDC and other health officials was, you know, these masks are completely useless, right? Don't bother wearing these masks. You know, when a doctor or nurse wears them, they somehow magically know what to do with them and it's helpful. But when you wear them, it's not helpful. And then the consensus sort of flipped a month or so later into taking it seriously and saying that these masks is what everybody has to wear. In a sort of slightly similar way, we forget that the political valence of worrying about the pandemic really flipped. In January and February of 2020, it was sort of a bunch of people in Silicon Valley and a few other people who are sort of talking about exponential growth numbers and this pandemic is going to be serious. And it was a lot of the media establishment, you know, and actually some leaders of the Democratic Party who were saying, if you're worrying about this, you're just kind of a racist who thinks that Chinese people have these dirty diseases or something like that. And then it's sort of, again, the partisan valence of that flipped very quickly. So what I'm struck by is not just that we ended up in these argumentative silos where partisan polarization governed what people were going to think and governed in some ways how journalists covered this whole thing. It's that the nature of the beliefs within these silos flipped, but then very quickly people were consistent within their ideological camps in adopting the new belief that a month later they thought was characteristic of the other team.
Yeah, that's a superb point. And I just want to talk a little bit about the mask point, and then, which is that, I mean, we all know what happened. Fauci famously went on 60 Minutes and said, masks don't work. You might touch your face and have some countervailing harm. So it doesn't work. Don't use it. And then 6 weeks later, he said, masks do work. And then later, when asked to explain that flip, he said, well, I didn't want you to buy up the masks for the healthcare providers. That's why I lied to you initially. But to me, that explanation is itself a lie. And here's why. Because when he came back 6 weeks later, he didn't say use a surgical mask or an N95. He said, we still have a PPE shortage. So use a homemade cloth mask. Cut your sock, cut your t-shirt, etc. If he was going, and that's what they recommended. And then from 2020 until 2021, most people on the street were wearing a cloth mask. But if he was going to come 6 weeks later and say, don't use a surgical or N95 mask, use a cloth mask, why wouldn't he have said that 6 weeks sooner? You still had the t-shirt, you still had the sock.
I have a potential explanation for that. You know, I always tend to think that incompetence is the explanation instead of malice. It's not always the case, but I think, you know, by and large, there's more incompetence going around in the world than malice. And if you can explain something by incompetence, that's a better way of doing it. I think one of the huge blind spots of public health is that it doesn't think very much about economics. And that, you know, the right response in February of 2020 would have been, let's encourage as many manufacturers as possible to shift towards producing masks that would actually protect people. And then very quickly, we would have been able to have it supply, right? I remember there was, you know, this great scramble to try and get some kind of medical mask, or, you know, often sort of imported from China via Amazon or something like that. You know, people paid, I mean, many dollars per paper mask. A month later, the marketplace was flooded with cheap masks because a bunch of people saw an economic opportunity and they jumped at it. And so I think sort of one explanation here is that Fauci in February 2020 was in a scarcity mindset where it was like, well, there's a certain number of masks to go around and we got to make sure that they go to doctors and nurses. And a month later, because it became obvious how inventive people are at producing their own masks and perhaps we were seeing mask production ramp up, they realized a very obvious point that when you suddenly need a lot more masks in society, an industrial society like the United States, an extremely rich society like the United States is going to figure out how to have more masks in circulation.
I guess that's a fair point, but I guess the follow-up would be then, when he came back the second time, he didn't say buy a surgical mask, he said use a cloth mask. And the cloth mask recommendation lasted for year after year. So he knowingly told people to wear a mask that we did have evidence that it doesn't work.
How strong was the evidence at the time that these paper masks don't work?
It was extremely strong. So strong, for instance, that the Cochrane Review was negative. You can read the account by Tom Jefferson, the Cochrane Reviewer, that cloth masks certainly didn't work. And then there's a second issue between, does an N95 mask work? And the answer is, in some way, yes. If I wear it perfectly and I go in a room, you know, it's going to work. But does a community recommendation for people to wear an N95 actually work? And the answer to that is probably no, because nobody can wear it correctly. Nobody can sustain it for hour after hour. The reason he went on initially and said it didn't work was that multiple random, 16 randomized studies showed it didn't work. That was the consensus. That's why CDC said it, WHO. He went back and lied only because of a propaganda campaign launched by some scientists who believed that masks had these theoretical benefits. I'm not convinced that masking did much in the entire pandemic, even to today.
So explain to me, sorry to double down on this, but explain to me what your theory of mind about Anthony Fauci is, right? And again, I have the instinct to assume that people aren't malevolent.
I don't think he's malevolent. He's not evil. He's incompetent.
So I have a relatively straightforward way of making sense of his flip, right? But like, he thinks, look, these masks probably have some benefit. We don't know how much benefit they have. Certainly, we need to be able to give doctors and nurses some of these masks, right? And so in February of 2020, he sort of engaged in what he thought of as a noble lie, right? Like, look, we probably have some benefits for ordinary people, but the more urgently needed in hospitals, we don't know how much benefit they're going to have. So I will sort of say that they have no benefit for ordinary people because that's the best way we have to make sure that doctors and nurses are going to have access to these things. And then by March 2020, when there was enough supply of these masks for doctors and nurses by and large, right, or at least the need, the shortfall was not as urgent, he said, look, okay, go and get masks. If possible, make your own mask. And he sort of thought they would have some amount of benefit. That to me is a coherent story that can explain both why he did something that I think was factually wrong and morally wrong. I don't think a public health official should tell a noble lie, right? I think that he's on the hook for having made that mistake. But that makes sense of his motivations in a kind of straightforward way. What's your story? If it was that obvious that masks didn't work in March 2020, why did he lie in March 2020?
Your story is his story. I mean, that's his story. That's the story he says that what happened. Here's, I think, my story. My story is one, we have to think about what his mentality was when this happened. So just now we know from a lot of leaked documents that he actually probably did worry that lab leak was the culprit origin of the virus. He had bitten funding through NIH grants, the EcoHealth Alliance, which was conducting gain-of-function research in Wuhan. I mean, I think, so he's worried that he's on the hook for this thing. Then in February, when he goes on TV the first time, he says what he genuinely believes, which is in accordance with the Cochrane Review, WHO, CDC. It's not just him. Every public health authority globally says masks don't work because that's what multiple randomized studies show in community settings, that masking doesn't work. We never recommend it for influenza, et cetera. Then what happened was in the next 6 weeks, and this is nicely depicted in a paper by Jacob Hale Russell called The Mask Debacle, there is an organized campaign among scientists to push the idea that cloth mask works. The idea is driven by aerosol studies, by mechanistic science, and that campaign has a lot of signatories. It's called hashtag masks for all. People are tweeting about it. And then I think, like so many policy issues, when he goes back in March and flip-flops and says cloth masks, he's doing it to capitulate to what he thinks people want to hear. And I think he's not doing what he thinks is a scientific thing. He's just saying, okay, I tried to tell them the truth about masks, and now they really want them. And you know what? Screw it. It doesn't do anything anyway. And so let them have it. A cloth mask, cut your sock off and put it on. So I think he's lying the second time.
Why are these scientists on Twitter and so on campaigning for masks?
Because they're not good scientists.
Okay, but so they just get this, they get the evidence wrong. Like they're motivated by stopping the disease or by saving people's lives, and they just get it wrong, right? I mean, they don't have a nefarious purpose.
No, nobody has a nefarious purpose. They're just not good. There's one, they're in their house, they're scared, they're panicking. And then the other thing is many scientists put too much weight on mechanistic studies. Like, yes, if you spray aerosol through the cloth, Some of it will be trapped. But that's different than making a policy recommendations where you ask people to wear cloth masks and measure the impact of that policy. So I think they don't study policy. Most of the people who are on these signatories are like mechanistic sciences. But no, I don't think anyone's nefarious in the sense that they're not trying to recommend masks as a scam. But let me say this, they're also doing some crazy things. I mean, in the summer of 2020, I saw people saying, I saw somebody at the Home Depot not wearing a mask. I asked the store clerk, why don't you confront that person? And I'm thinking to myself, you know, again, this person doesn't think about policy. A policy where 17-year-old kids working in Home Depot confront the person not wearing a mask is going to lead to bloodshed and violence and all these kind of crazy things, and it's not going to help anybody. If you see someone not wearing a mask, you can just walk around them a little bit, okay? So these people are kind of caught up in a frenzy in the summer of 2020.
Well, there's a real question, right? I mean, again, like if you wear a mask correctly and consistently and so on, what effect is it going to have? And when, if you force a lot of people, some of whom are more conscientious and some of whom are less conscientious, to follow these rules, is it going to make a difference? When obviously we had the famous, you know, what is the, thankfully I've forgotten all this terminology, the sort of mask beard or something like that, you know, where people just like have it hang around their sort of chin. The other day I saw somebody wear a mask, which is now a relatively rare occurrence, and then suddenly I heard something spit next to me, and I saw that this lady who was wearing a mask, had taken off the mask for a moment to spit on the ground next to me indoors at Penn Station and put the mask back on, right? So, you know, people are going to engage in weird behaviors in the real world, and if we want to know what the impact of policy is, we have to imagine it in a real-world context and try and study it in a real-world context. And I certainly believe that that was one of the failures. You know, again, there was a moment when we were holding people back from school in places like New York, where the health system was really being overloaded, where perhaps in March of 2020, we didn't quite know with the same amount of certainty what the fatality rate might turn out to be for young children. But then sort of by the summer of 2020, right, we can see that hospitals are not overloaded. At that point, there's much better evidence at that point, you know, of how strongly age-correlated fatality for COVID is. So at that point, you know, the argument for opening schools becomes much stronger. You know, I'm not a public health expert, not an epidemiologist. I always had some amount of difficulties figuring out the different sides of that trade-off, right? I think it's hard when there's a trade-off and there's genuine costs on both sides to figure out what on balance is the right course of action. What I was struck by in the discussions at the time is the confident claims that little children wearing masks all through the school day or children, you know, going to school via Zoom rather than in person was essentially costless. But there's no real cost of that. And it always struck me that sort of in order to make this argument for school closures, people were willing to discount the cost on one side in a way that I always found to be intellectually dishonest, whatever your view might be about how the different costs overall stack up. So what do you think, closing schools in New York City in the beginning of March 2020, reasonable or not reasonable? Making kids wear, you know, masks in elementary school in September 2020, reasonable or not reasonable? Some school districts, some private schools just doing online Zoom class for a year or 2 years, reasonable or not reasonable?
Yeah, so first I think it's important to have some global perspective. Sweden never closed elementary schools, not even one day. And Sweden only closed middle and high school for 6 to 8 weeks. Switzerland, 6 weeks. France, like 10 weeks. Everybody gets to me a pass for the first 10 weeks of 2020. From March 2020, everybody gets a pass, closed schools for 10 weeks, 12 weeks. That's fine. You know, only Sweden made the right decision around elementary school kids. But in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., Chicago, schools were closed for 18 months. They were closed all the entire next calendar year. And that, to me, is the part that's absolutely unjustified. What do we know at the time? We knew from the Swedish experience by the summer of 2020 that schools could safely be run in elementary school settings. What do we know about masking kids? The European CDC suggested no child under the age of 6 should ever wear a mask. The Americans went down to 2 years old. Now that's a bizarre, that's sort of a crazy thing. That's an American delusion to think that cloth masking a 2-year-old will work. And that was an extremely controversial and misguided policy that I think created backlash. In terms of schools, there's a huge benefit to children to being in schools in terms of their upward mobility and their education. And we see massive learning losses now. The downside was we thought that even if it wasn't so deadly for kids, that school closure would slow the spread of virus in communities. But by the summer of 2020, there were some elegant economic papers, one from Germany, that looked at Germany has staggered summer holidays, and they took advantage of that sort of natural variation in when schools were open and closed to ask, if you close and reopen the school, what's the change in transmission in that county? And the answer was that study found no change in transmission in the county from opening or closing schools. And then we have another study by the USC investigators here that showed by the fall of 2020, we're talking about like very, very tiny or no difference in transmission from school closure. So here on one side of the ledger, you get massive learning losses and all the attendant harms of closing schools. On the other side, you're getting no change in transmission and kids aren't affected that much. To me, reopening schools by the fall of 2020 was a no-brainer. That was fought vehemently. And that was fought predominantly, Biden ran a campaign where he had political ads that said, it's Donald Trump wants to put your kids back in school. That's dangerous. Famously, Randy Weingartner and the teachers union, they stubbornly opposed school reopening. School reopening in the fall of 2020 is not linked to cases or hospitalizations or anything. It's linked to the strength of the teachers union and how liberal a city is. So to me, school closure is the great domestic policy failure of 2020, at least in the fall.
And how lasting have the effects of learning loss and other kinds of social disadvantages proven? Do we know something? And we know that they were very strong in the years immediately after COVID. To me, there was then a question about, is this just going to compound? And if you didn't learn to read and write properly in third grade, second grade, first grade, you know, is that just going to stick with you and you don't make any of those steps? Or is that something that teachers can remedy over time, right? If a kid is actually capable of learning to read and write and doing math, if they have that aptitude, perhaps they're behind the curve, but over time, that may come to matter less. You know, we have examples of terribly disruptive wars, which completely threw off the educational trajectories of many people, but them, coming back and being able to make up that kind of learning loss over time in the years after the war. So, you know, do we know sort of how lasting these effects have proven so far?
I mean, I think the data as of 2023 shows still massive gaps that remain unclosed and something like 20 to 30 years lost of progress from like the 1990s have been lost from school closure. And then the other thing is we talk about school closure like they're just not learning to read and write. But reading and writing are linked to so many things in life, like the job you get and how much money you make and how long you live. So I suspect what you will find as these kids grow up is you'll find more teen pregnancy, violence as teenagers, more perhaps incarceration, and you'll find them living poorer lives and shorter lives. And that will be disproportionately borne by poor Black inner city communities, particularly communities in these left cities. So to me, it was the least progressive policy position. I wrote so many op-eds at the time. It was the way in which really Democrats and Democratic cities failed the poor minority kids they claim to care about.
Yeah, and I think there's certainly an element of pretending to be on the side of the weakest while actually neglecting the interests of the weakest, right? I mean, nothing is more important for values like quote-unquote equity than making sure that people from deeply disadvantaged communities have an opportunity to learn the basic skills that are going to allow you to get decent jobs in the world. And so to sort of give in to teachers' unions, which are full of people who are, you know, certainly not the most privileged people in the world, but certainly also not the most underprivileged people in the world, to serve their interests over the interests of some of those kids that they should have been teaching is certainly a significant failure, I think. We haven't yet really talked about the vaccine. You know, that is, in a sense, a big success story, right? I mean, the one thing that has allowed us to get out of this pandemic faster than we might have done otherwise, and the one way in which human ingenuity really was incredible during the pandemic was the record speed at which we developed these vaccines. Now, we also learned relatively early on that the vaccines were not quite the golden grail that we had hoped. They very significantly reduced fatality rates, very significantly reduced how likely people were to become seriously sick from COVID. But we learned quite early on in the rollout of the vaccine that we did not stop transmission in the way that we had hoped a little bit earlier. Are vaccines the big success story here? And where do you think we went wrong in terms of how we rolled out the vaccine and encouraged people to get them?
Yeah, I think your summary is pretty accurate. I'm 100% persuaded that an older, unvaccinated person who did not have COVID-19 definitely benefit from the vaccine in January, February, and March of 2021. So a 70-year-old person who had never had COVID, that vaccine dramatically reduces their risk of severe disease and hospitalization from COVID-19. And that was the biggest success story of the pandemic, the development of such an effective vaccine. Now, what I'm not sure about is, if a 20-year-old had already had COVID-19, do they benefit from getting the dose of the vaccine? The way to answer that question would have been to ask Pfizer to do a special study in people who had and recovered from COVID-19. They didn't do that study. Now, the reason that's important is later, they're going to mandate that vaccine in people who've had COVID-19. And They're going to fire them if they don't do it. Okay. The next thing is, I'm not sure if a 20-year-old man benefits from dose two.
When it comes to this question of firing, I think that's where basic liberal principles like the harm principle come in. I certainly understand why, if we think that the vaccine impedes the transmission of the disease, there would be a very strong argument for doctors and nurses to have the vaccine, for example, right? You obviously don't want to put patients who presumably already have compromised health at additional risk of contracting a disease because the doctor and the nurse isn't taking the vaccine that is possibly leading to its spread. I could even get the argument, again, there's liberty interest on the other side, but I could get the argument that this is true for other kinds of people in service roles. Certainly that companies should be allowed to say, hey, you know, we want people to feel comfortable coming to our restaurant. And part of that is to say, perhaps the patrons of a restaurant, certainly our staff at the restaurant, has to be vaccinated because that's going to reduce the transmission and it's going to make our customers feel comfortable being here. Perhaps you want to make sure that there's some supermarkets where people can go to with that reduced risk. All of those arguments become a lot less compelling when you have data that shows that getting the vaccine reduces your risk, but it doesn't reduce in the same way the likelihood that you transmit it, right? Because then we're really in the realm of a paternalistic state where we're saying, in order to reduce your risk of mortality, whether or not it in fact does for somebody who's 20 years old and had a previous disease that I can't speak to, but in order to reduce your risk of mortality, we are taking these very, very heavy-handed measures to force you to take an action. For me, that is the key distinction.
Yeah, that's exactly the key distinction, which is that as a general rule of public health, we think it is a prerequisite to mandate a personal health intervention if and only if there is enough benefit to third parties, it outweighs my loss of autonomy. So there has to be that third party benefit. And what I'll point out to you is that every single mandate in the United States, from the federal government mandate to the school mandates to the college mandates to the hospital mandates, they were all implemented after we knew the vaccine does not and cannot halt transmission. No mandate was implemented in early January, in early 2021. They all came in the fall of 2020, 2021, when we already knew that the vaccine does almost nothing to stop transmission, that the virus has escaped transmission. And then the other point I'd make to you is that these mandates are extremely harmful. And the other point I make to you is that if we wanted to know if the vaccine slowed transmission, we could have asked Pfizer to take people in the study and swab their family members randomly every few months to see does it slow transmission. The FDA has repeatedly not asked Pfizer to generate data that might lend some value to these debates. We can talk about the booster. Now they're saying that I have to get, you know, you have to get a booster every year and every 6 months. So the company is not being made to generate data to support these claims. And so we've kind of fallen down this path where, okay, two and done, now three and done, actually now 8, 9 shots and done, and actually you need a shot every 6 months for the rest of your life. We are getting to the point where it's got taken on absurd qualities in my mind. But your distinction is absolutely right. To mandate someone, you need benefit to third parties. They never had that. So that to me is always problematic.
How did we end up with that? I mean, again, to try and have a sympathetic read of where these policies come from, I mean, it was a genuine conviction that, my God, we now have these vaccines. They're life-saving. If only we get as many people as possible to get these vaccines as fast as possible, that's the way we're going to get out of this horrible pandemic situation with the least lives lost. And then in the zeal of trying to do that, people overstepped both these moral boundaries about sort of when it's appropriate to be paternalistic and perhaps started to misread the evidence and somehow thinking that if only we get everybody to take the vaccine, that's also going to stop transmission or something like that. But how do you explain why it is that public health authorities, broadly in conjunction with mainstream opinion in the media and the press, were pushing these kind of mandates at a moment when their value was at least dubious?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the two core points of this talk, which is one, they never had any debates on the topic. Again, I'm not aware of any debates held at any university on whether or not the vaccine mandates should be implemented or not. Number two, these decisions were made in private between a small group of people in the Biden administration, including the Surgeon General, and the people who work at Pfizer. We can't forget how closely the administration has worked in private with Pfizer and Moderna, the manufacturers of the vaccine. The manufacturers have a vested interest in mandates because that'll improve their market share. That to me is deeply problematic. And then finally, I think not hearing counterpoints, not hearing dissenting views. I don't think there's anybody on the inside who actually has a dissenting view. they don't include those scientists. And so I think those were sort of the reasons that set it up for that. The media, of course, once Trump was no longer in office, the media and the administration have largely been on the same page. I mean, I see the media is just putting, it's sort of a, they issued the press release of the Biden administration. I don't see any pushback on any of the claims. The last thing I'd say, Yasha, in 2021, Marion Gruber and Phil Krause, the director and deputy director of vaccine products, they resigned because they said this White House was pressuring them to approve a booster, even though they didn't think it had data for all ages. They resigned. They didn't resign when Trump was in office. They didn't say Trump was pressuring us to give the vaccine. They only resigned under the Biden administration.
What do you think, with the benefit of, you know, 4 years or so of research, the overall impact of the vaccine has been? We say, you know, if we think of a hypothetical question, if we had not managed to produce a vaccine as quickly as we did, which, you know, most people expected it to take longer, right? Would we have ended up in a kind of pandemic state for a lot longer? Would we, broadly speaking, have ended up with a similar timeline, but with more people dying and particularly more elderly people passing away as a result? Sort of what hypothetically would the world look like in which we didn't get a vaccine?
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, so I'd say the vaccine saved the lives of lots of elderly people. You would have continued, we continued to, and we will continue to have rises and falls of COVID like transmission, but we dramatically blunted the death rate by having the vaccine when it came out.
Let's go to the question of the lab leak theory. Now, in a way, I think it's very important that debate about this was effectively shut down. I mean, in particular, I believe Facebook and YouTube actually literally censored any suggestion that the lab leak was, that a lab leak was at the origin of the COVID pandemic. I think in terms of policy and sort of our basic freedoms, that is a very, very significant question. In a sense, you can say it's a historical question at this point. Beyond that, right, I mean, whether this originated in animals like bats or whether it originated in gain-of-function research in a lab in which somebody made some kind of error and by mistake it ended up leaking from that lab. One way or the other, this was a terrible tragedy and perhaps it doesn't matter. Except that it, of course, raises questions about the practice of gain-of-function research, right? If we can't exclude the possibility that one of the worst pandemics in the last 150 years of the 21st century was originated by gain-of-function research, well, then perhaps we should stop engaging in gain-of-function research. And there's a kind of set of ideas around why gain-of-function research is valuable that I think the broader experience of a pandemic should make us skeptical of, right? The idea is, look, we should think about the different ways in which these viruses could evolve, because that way we can prepare vaccines for them, we can think about how to respond to them, and that's going to put us in better stead if these viruses somehow evolve naturally, right? But given our failure to actually stop COVID in its tracks, given how irrational a lot of the policy response was, there's a real question about whether if we figure out the possibility of various viruses that is in fact going to help us protect from them, and if then there's at least a possibility that in fact this very research causes the pandemic that it's meant to help us manage, well, should we ban gain-of-function research? What is the implication for this field of scientific study?
Yeah, that's a great point. The questions are like, what are the points going forward? One, it is a historical question. Two, I think this research continues to be funded. The EcoHealth Alliance, they got their grant renewed after all these issues have been raised to light. There continues to be gain-of-function research happening globally. Perhaps that should, not perhaps, I think I'm of the belief it should all be halted. Number four, it needs to be investigated to know the extent to which Francis Collins and Anthony Fauci and others lied about their complicity in the gain-of-function research. And that, I think, may include perjury charges, given what they had said to Congress. Those, I think, are the sort of the salient things going forward, what to do about it. But I agree with you. I think that gain-of-function research, what has it accomplished? It led to the single greatest pandemic of the last 25 years and the death of millions of people globally. That's not a good track record for making us safer, if that is, in fact, what happened.
How certain are you that the origin of COVID is, in fact, the lab leak? Your answer to the last question implies that you're certain of this. My understanding is that there continues to be scientific debate about it. Clearly, this is a theory that is now taken very, very seriously at the highest level of governments and by many, many scientists. But my understanding is that we still cannot be certain about what happened. It sounds like you believe that it was, in fact, a lab leak.
I think that's the way I lean, but I agree with you. I'm not certain that it happened. I think it's the belief of the FBI and the Department of Energy and a number of federal agencies have come to that conclusion. Ultimately, you know, people say it's hard to prove. But the truth is that somebody knows the answer to whether or not it's lab leak, because there was somebody who, I don't think it would be intentional, I think it would be an accident, somebody who was working there at the Wuhan Institute who got sick and then went home and spread it. That's probably, and once you get the testimony of those people, you would know the answer. So I think it's knowable, but I'm not, you know, nobody knows it's 100% sure. I don't think anyone could be 100%.
That sounds plausible, except, you know, I've had a bout of COVID somewhat recently, I mean, 6 months ago or so, and I never quite tested positive for COVID at the time, but I'm pretty sure it was COVID based on the sort of various symptoms of it. I mean, there must be people who work at the COVID Institute of Virology who got sick at some point in November and December of 2019, who may genuinely not be sure in retrospect whether it was COVID or not, right? Clearly, they didn't have access to tests at the time. They must be thinking, well, you know, I work with this virus. The symptoms kind of line up with what the virus is, but like it could have just been something else. I mean, do we know that they would really know, or is there a possibility that they're thinking back to some illness they had 3 months earlier, thinking, was that COVID in retrospect, or perhaps it wasn't?
That's a great point. But I guess I can't imagine there are many people who actually work in that facility with access to this particular virus and the virus strain. And then I guess they would also know if whether or not they have a virus with the exact same sequence as the SARS-CoV-2 virus, you know, from their strain. So I think those are the ways in which they could know, and whether or not they genetically manipulated that strain, you know. But you're right. I think that they may not know why they were sick. Yeah.
What are the lessons for the next pandemic, and do you think we're going to heed those lessons?
The lessons for the next pandemic, I think, what's the result of this pandemic? The result of this pandemic is massive political division. If there is a pandemic in the next 20 years, you're going to see two states. You're going to see the red states doing something completely different than the blue states. And what you're also going to see is they may both make mistakes. The red states are likely not to do anything, even if doing some things would be valuable because it'll be a different virus. And the blue states are likely to do everything, even if that's unnecessary as well. You'll also see migration, probably more than you saw in this pandemic. People who don't like blue state policies will move. Like I will move to Florida, you know, for instance, because if I think the policies are heavy-handed in my state of California. And then I think you'll get more and more division and bitterness. And I think implementing things like mask mandates and vaccine mandates will lead to more backlash. I think we're extremely vulnerable to any threat that requires a coordinated action because we're more polarized than ever before.
One of the things I wondered about is there could be circumstances under which new social distancing measures are justified. You know, we got lucky in certain respects with this horrible, horrible pandemic. I mean, it killed many, 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 many people, and I don't want to make light of that in any kind of way. But the case fatality rate ended up being much, much, much lower than we feared in February and March of 2020, right? You could have a virus with some similar characteristics, like the fact that it develops slowly and so people can spread it asymptomatically, which makes it very hard to control. But where the case fatality rate ends up being 3% rather than 0.1% or whatever we now believe it is, right? It could be one, like the Spanish influenza, that kills 20-year-olds with a much higher likelihood rather than people who are elderly. You could imagine a pandemic that is much worse than COVID has been. And it seems to me that even if that calculus should then point towards energetic social distancing measures, this is no world in which certainly the United States, but even many countries in Europe and elsewhere in the world, are going to engage in that set of steps. So have we sort of doubly hampered our possible response to future pandemics?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think that even if there were circumstances where it might be of benefit, we were not going to do it because we have so much political backlash. But the other thing I'd point out is that we didn't bring up this point. We actually didn't study any of these measures. In the United States, we ran zero studies of community masking. We didn't know studies. Anthony Fauci said to do it. He controls the budget to run the research to do it. We ran zero studies. We didn't study school reopening and school closure. We didn't study social distancing. We don't know the right distance, 6 feet we made up. We actually are no smarter about how to handle the next pandemic because we didn't do any studies. So I think we have both a crisis of evidence and a crisis of confidence. And I think those two will not serve us well going forward.
Well, there's a old curse. This sounds like one of these things that's probably apocryphal. Supposedly, there's an old Chinese curse that says, may you live in interesting times. It was very interesting to live through this terrible pandemic. One pandemic is enough for my lifetime. I hope it's enough for all of us. And I hope that we won't face the consequences of this failure in the form of another pandemic anytime in our lifetimes. Vinay, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for the opportunity, Yasha.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good Fight. Lots of listeners have been spreading the word about this show. If you too have been enjoying the podcast, please be like them. Rate the show on iTunes, tell your friends all about it, share it on Facebook or Twitter. And finally, please mail suggestions for great guests or comments about the show to goodfightpod@gmail.com. That's goodfightpod@gmail.com.
This recording carries a Creative Commons 4.0 international license. Thanks to Silent Partner for their song, Chess Pieces.